The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, public transport is fantastic, except for one thing. It's public. You have to catch it with other people. So what are your pet peeves about public transport? Is it the man spread? Is it the person who falls asleep on your shoulder? The person listening to live music? What stresses me about public transport is when you get off the train, we're all going up the stairs, but there'll be one man trying to go the other way, fighting against the crowd, going down the stairs, trying to catch his train. You feel like just saying to him, buddy, give up. The train has left. You're going the wrong way. And maybe that's what it feels like right now to be a person of faith. The train has left. We're going the wrong way. We may as well just go with the crowd. Over the last few years, what's been popular on social media is the deconversion story. Christians who are now deconverting and giving up their faith and going with the crowd. So why shouldn't we do the same? Well, welcome to our Daniel series. We're looking at how to thrive, how to survive in a post-faith world. To do that, we're looking at stories from the book of Daniel. Today, we're looking at Daniel chapter 3. It's a long story. I can't go through the whole story. I'll just draw out some points, some ideas from the story. And our question is this: how can we survive in a post-faith world? And in the story, we meet Daniel's three friends. And I reckon if they're around today, this is what they'll look like: countercultural, edgy, and cool. Or maybe this is what they look like: defiant. Or this is what they look like: one person standing against the juggernaut of an oppressive regime. Well, what can we learn from Daniel's three friends? Well, I'm going to say this. We can learn some similar things about their age and our age, and also some points of application. We can learn this. What's similar about their age and our age is this: every age will have a God to bow down to. Every age will have a God to bow down to. I remember when Daniel chapter 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Verse 4, nations and peoples of every language, this is what you're commanded to do. You must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. The king commands the three friends to worship the God that he has set up, and every age will ask us to worship the God that it has set up. I remember when my wife was pregnant with our second child, heavily pregnant. I thought, hey, let's go to the Sydney Opera House. Let's watch one last show before the baby comes along. Let's just be adults for one last time before our second child comes along. But as you know, the problem with the Sydney Opera House is trying to find parking. And so I went everywhere looking for free parking. Because as an Asian, we will pay $100 for a seafood dish, but we won't pay $5 for parking. And finally, I found free parking on Pitt Street, like 10 blocks away. So I made my heavily pregnant wife walk 10 blocks because I didn't want to pay for parking. And that's because as an Asian, I worship the God of free parking. I value free parking above anything else. I will do whatever it takes to find free parking. In traditional cultures, we worship family. We do whatever it takes to make our parents happy. We value family above all things. In capitalist cultures, we worship the dollar. We do whatever we can to make the markets happy. We value our personal wealth above all things. In post-traditional cultures, we value personal happiness. You only live once. You got to do whatever it takes to be happy. And maybe in family cultures, we worship our children. We do whatever it takes to get them ahead. We want to do whatever it takes to make them happy. See, every age will have a God. Just because we stop believing in God doesn't mean we don't have gods, because nature abhors a vacuum. We'll find a new God to replace the God we stop believing in. This is the Atlantic. It just came out this year. They had a whole article on how work has become the new religion. We've stopped believing God, so now we look to work to be our salvation, our identity, our status, our security. So every age will have its God that we have to worship. What's also similar about Daniel's time and now is this. Every age also expects you to conform to its God. Verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar then summoned, and I put in green these words because there's a parody going on, and hopefully you can hear the parody that's going on. Nebuchadnezzar then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. Verse 3, so the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assemble for the dedication of the image. Verse 4, then the herald loudly proclaimed, nations and peoples of every language, this is what you're commanded to do. Verse 5, as soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Verse 7, therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Well, what's going on here? Now, I have a backyard with lots of grass. What would you do with a backyard with lots of grass? If you're an Anglo-Australian, well, you mow the lawn. But if you're an Asian Australian, you grow vegetables in it. So you can sell it. You got to monetize your backyard. If you're an Italian Australian, like all my neighbors are, they will concrete it because it's functional, it's practical, but it's also drab, grey, and boring. And that's a problem with concrete. This is brutalist architecture. Its feature is concrete on the outside, functional, practical, but drab, dull, and boring. And it's a feature of Eastern European architecture. And that's why they call it brutalist architecture. It's drab, grey, conformist, and brutalist. And that's what this passage is trying to show us. There's something brutalist going on here. Satraps, prefects, governors, advisors. Satraps, prefects, governors, advisors. Horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp. Horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp. Nations, peoples, every language. Nations, peoples, every language. People are just conforming. They've lost their individuality. It's drab, grey, conformist, and brutalist. But we do the same in every age. I lived in the USA for 5 years, and over there, the Conservative Party, the Republicans, everyone had to have a flag pin on their lapel, and everyone had to conform. So when you go to the convention, all you see is flag pin, flag pin, flag pin, flag pin. And whenever there's a disaster, they all say the same thing. Our thoughts and prayers, 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 our thoughts and prayers. But then on the Democrat side, the left side, they do the same at the recent debates. Everyone said they're for open borders, 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 open borders. And then we virtue signal our loyalty to show we're conforming, we're okay. So if you're a conservative church in America, you will have the national flag. If you're a progressive church, you'll have the rainbow flag. In Asian work cultures, you turn up to work early and then you're the last to leave. You wear the official work wear. In city, urban cultures, on Earth Hour, you better turn your lights off. We all conform. There's something drab, grey, and brutalist. So what can we learn from the three Jews? Well, here I'm going to say we can learn three things from the three Jews in this story. Number one is this. Trust that God has everything under control. No matter what is happening, trust that God has this under control, and we are here exactly because this is what God wants. Verse 14, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, if you don't worship this image, you will be thrown into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? That's the challenge. And the reply is this. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this measure. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, We want you to know, Your Majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. My wife and I love having dinner parties. We love cooking and we love inviting people over. But if I run a dinner party, this is my go-to dish, spaghetti bolognese, because it can't go wrong. You've cooked it 100 times before. It's guaranteed, stress-free, comes out the same every time. But when my wife runs a dinner party, that's her chance to experiment. That's when she comes home with ingredients we've never cooked before. She's going, hey, I bought some quail. Let's cook quail. I think, we have never cooked quail before. Hey, I've come with some octopus. Let's do octopus. I think, what are you doing? She experiments. This is her chance to try something she's never done before. I think, oh, but at the end of every dinner party, it goes well. And I have to keep telling myself, what are you thinking? You need to just trust her. She has it under control. And Daniel's three friends, they don't know why King Nebuchadnezzar has invaded and destroyed Jerusalem. They don't know why they're exiled in Babylon right now. And they don't know why they're being forced to worship an image they don't want to worship. But they do know this. God has this under control. And they are here exactly because this is where God wants them to be. And it's the same for us here right now. We don't know why maybe we have to work for a narcissist boss who's a bully. We don't know why we have health issues like asthma, diabetes, or depression. We don't know why we've just had to lose a loved one, but we trust that God has it under control. And maybe for Christians, we don't know why maybe our church didn't get its lease renewed next year. We don't know if we'll be allowed to teach scripture in schools next year. We don't know if we'll be allowed to have chaplains in universities in 10 years' time, but we do know this. God has it all under control, and we are here exactly because this is where God wants us to be. The second thing we can learn from Daniel's three friends is this. Trust that God will be with you in all of this. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement, and he asked his advisors, weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire? Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Somehow God has sent maybe the second person of the Trinity, the angel Lord, in the flames with Daniel's three friends. They are not there alone. God is with them. I remember when my wife was heavily pregnant with our first child, and I was driving to her to the hospital to give birth, and I thought, boy, childbirth has changed a lot in the last few decades. Like 30 years ago, they made the man wait outside. The woman gave birth, they made the man wait outside, he could not come in. Now they make the man go inside, they drag you in there kicking and screaming, even when you don't want to be in there. So there I was, and they hand you your child. And I remember holding my child and thinking, my goodness, what have we done? Because there's no instruction manual. We don't know what to do. And then at this moment, my mind went to a funny place because I'm a doctor and a theologian. I thought, whoa, we have brought you into this world. And this is not a happy world. This is a world where there's pain, evil, and suffering. You're going to get your bones broken playing rugby. You're going to get your heart broken by a girl. And being a doctor, no, you have a 1 in 3 chance of catching cancer. What have we done? But I knew this, that no matter what happens, I will be there with you. You will not be alone. And this is what, and God promises those who trust and follow him, he guarantees suffering. He doesn't say he'll remove suffering, but he guarantees he will be with them in that suffering. And he sends a fourth person to be there in the flames. And maybe he is a precursor, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. But for us, God sends his son Jesus to suffer with us, to suffer on a cross, and also to rise from the dead, to say there's another chapter still to come. So there is hope in all of this. My youngest child, whenever I tell him to take a shower, he refuses. He won't take a shower. And at first I thought he was being defiant. And suddenly I only realized this recently, he was actually afraid. Maybe he thought bad things were going to happen to him in the shower. So he always asked me to be in the bathroom with him as he took the shower. And when I did that, suddenly he was happy to take a shower. As long as I was there with him, then he knew he was going to be okay. And it's the same with us. No matter where we find ourselves in life, and remember, God doesn't guarantee to remove suffering. He does the opposite. He guarantees suffering, especially for those who follow him. But God will be with us. The third thing is this. Trust that God really is the one and only true God. Verse 28, we have this stunning reversal from King Nebuchadnezzar, who says, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him, and they defied the king's command, my command, and they were willing to give up their lives rather than to serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be cut into pieces. For," and this is a punchline to the whole story, "no other God can save in this way. I work in the city, and to get in and out of the city, I ride a bicycle. I love riding a bicycle because every day is a near-death experience. And so every day I have is a day I thank God for. It's a day I should not have had, but I have. So every day is a day I'm thankful to God for." And people always say, "Don't ride your bike, it's too dangerous." I remember my first year of work, a mini cyclone hit Sydney, the Sydney CBD. And it was so bad, the Premier gave evacuation orders. Like, if you don't have to be in Sydney, get out of Sydney. It was a day when streets were flooded, backyards washed out into the ocean, and the Premier said, "You don't need to be here, get out now." There were evacuation orders. And everyone looked at me on my bicycle and said, "You're not going to ride that." And I said, "But what other option is there?" Because on that day, the streets were blocked, public transport was not working, and I rode my bike, and I actually took this photo, Piedmont Bridge, and that's what it looked like, and I got out. It was actually the only way out of city. So it wasn't just the better way, it wasn't just the best way, it was actually the only way out of the city. And Daniel's three friends, they put their trust in God. Yes, God has everything under control. Yes, God is there with them in the flames, but in the end, they haven't found just a better way. They haven't found just a best way. They've actually found the only God who can save them. And the same with us. When we put our trust in God, we haven't found just a better way, a best way. We have found the only way, because there is no other God who can save us. Because if we worship our children as gods, they will never be good enough for us, and we will never be good enough for them. If we worship work as our God, it will never be good enough for us, and we will never be good enough for it. If we worship personal happiness, we will never be happy enough. But if we trust in Jesus, we have a God who will fulfill us and forgive us. And we don't have to be good enough for this God. He will always be good enough for us. So in this story, we've seen the brutalist, grey, drab, conformist culture of Babylon. And Daniel's three friends, because they trust in God, poof, they stand out. Everyone else is one-dimensional. They're three-dimensional in this story. Everyone is just grey and drab. They are in colour. Everyone else is nameless. These guys are the only ones with names in the story. They stand out. This is Kodak. When I was a boy, Kodak was quite a thing. But it's no longer around. In fact, the top 100 companies at the turn of the last century aren't the top 100 companies anymore. Companies come and companies go. And kingdoms come and kingdoms go. Cultural trends come and cultural trends go. But only the kingdom of God will last forever. And if we trust in this God, the God of Daniel's three friends, we will find a God who has everything under control. We will find a God who will be with us no matter what. But most importantly, we won't have found just a better way or a best way. We'll find the only way to be saved.
Okay, a few questions here, Sam. Would you like to come
Sure.
We'll have a go. First one, where was Daniel when his mates were in the blazing furnace?
That's what I love about Bible stories. There's a deliberate ambiguity, and we don't know. And I think that's okay. It's okay not to know. And the answer is, I don't know.
What is the God of law, or what is law's God?
You mean like the legal profession?
I think so, yeah.
Well, I'm not a lawyer.
What's our God?
I'm not you. I can't say, but I can say.
What would you guess?
I know for surgeons, like, okay, I'll share this story. I was in the change room in the hospitals, and there was another surgical assistant, and we assist orthopedic surgeons, and he said to me, what do you have today? I said, whoa, for something completely different, we've got knees. We've got knees, because I work with a knee surgeon, and in the days of super specialization, he only does knees. So I've got a whole list of only knees. And somehow you sort of, oh, we've just got knees. And then I actually said to this other assistant, you know, I'm sick of knees. Like, every day I wake up, what have I got today? Knees. I'm going to hold a leg and we're going to operate on a knee. And I said to him, I don't know how these surgeons do it. Like, every single day, they're just going to operate on a knee and do the same operation. It's like a golf swing or change the oil on your car. It's the same thing day after day after day. And he said to me, you know what it is? Ego. That's what keeps them going. And I said, well, you know, it's like Ian Thorpe. Ian Thorpe complained about the black line. Remember, he said, I'm retiring because I'm sick of seeing the black line where you're just doing lap in the swimming pool and all you see is a black line. And for us surgeons, the same, all we're seeing is a knee. It's the same routine over and over again. And then this other assistant said, yes, but do you know what kept Ian Thorpe going? It was fame, glory, gold medals, success. Like, without that, you wouldn't put up with a black line. And once he got the gold medal, the fame, the glory, that's why he couldn't put up with a black line anymore. And he said, that's what keeps surgeons coming back, that moment when they come in the room and they are the king.
Does it satisfy them?
It's so hard because you guys record this. And one day my surgeon's going to find this. I shared this with the men in finance. I work with a surgeon who's the top of Everest. We operated yesterday and immediately he got chauffeur driven by Emirates because he was going to fly business to Dusseldorf in Germany where he's going to work on research and development for a new knee replacement. He's going to fly back business and he's going to start operating at another hospital on Monday. So he flies once or twice a year on business to be wined and dined by surgical companies and to teach. He did a knockdown rebuild of a house in the eastern suburbs. His wife's an interior designer, so they've been using his house to be the showpieces in interior decorating magazines. He has overseas holidays once or twice a year. Then he goes skiing by himself overseas with some guy friends. He has a BMW. Porsche contact him to test drive cars. And I thought, wow, this guy has it all. And then just about 12 months ago, I watched his whole life fall apart on me. He lost the house, the wife, his health, everything. And I just saw him just hobbling around. And I thought, oh, he has just lost everything. And he's always had his wall up for the last 5 years. But just the last month, as we operate, he's slowly letting his guard down and showing me his vulnerability. And he's not happy. I said to him just yesterday, hey, you know, how's your fitness going? How's your health? Because he used to do CrossFit. He used to always tell me how he's top of they have a table of achievers and he's at the top or second. And he said, oh, my cortisol level's actually sky high right now. And if you're medical, you understand cortisol is the enemy of fitness. It's catabolic instead of anabolic and it's caused by stress. And he said, my stress levels are sky high. And I said, oh, what's going on? And he just shared me how all these areas in his life just aren't working.
So do you think you're Daniel in that situation, maybe?
Maybe like salt and light. Okay. And what it is, we in City Bible Forum, work is a good thing. Yeah. You know, it's a blessing from God to have work. And it's our way of imaging God and an outlet for creativity and autonomy and basically being God or Adam working the garden. But if we try to make more of it than what it is, then it will destroy us and we will destroy ourselves as well. Like we look for status, identity, security, significance. I think that's a big one. If we look to work for significance, then it will destroy us.
Okay. Oh, thanks, Sam. Okay, one more question here. Given that God is in control, does that mean that he is happy with the state of the world today? And then a sub-point, I would argue that there is a sense of distinct lack of control, just from the evidence. You know, it's a good question.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you're at ground level, things look out of control. Or it's like when you've just emptied the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle box, you see the 1,000 pieces in front of you, oh my goodness, what is happening? But God has the big picture, the macro picture, and there is control, beauty, and wisdom. I shared earlier, it's like the Karate Kid. You know, he's being told to paint the fence, wax the car, and that makes no sense. But, you know, there's a bigger picture, and he finds out one day, oh, these are the moves. They'll win him. Or it's that moment we take your child to the doctor for vaccination, and they plunge that needle into the kid's thigh, and the kid looks at you in horror. Yeah. What happened? I just trusted you in this moment. You've betrayed me. But then they trust you. Okay, you must have a loving reason for what's going on. And no parent loves watching their kid get needles. That pains you as much as it pains the kid. But somehow there's still a wisdom, a purpose in all this. And it would have pained God to see his son die on the cross. And Jesus would have felt the pain too. And it would have pained him. And it pained him when he said to Jerusalem, 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 oh, if only, you know, I could have gathered you. But there's still a wisdom, a purpose in what was going on.
Okay. All right, to finish off, it's a very dangerous question given that your boss is in the back of the room.
Sure.
It's about, the first one's about King Nebuchadnezzar. Was he a narcissist? And then any advice for Christians in dealing with a leader or employer who might have a tendency like
that? Yeah, I have a saying, not every leader is a narcissist, but every narcissist will find a way to become a leader. So if you're a leader, there's a very high chance you are a narcissist or the guy you're working for is a narcissist. And so the sign of narcissists is pride and insecurity. The opposite of what we want is humility and security. So we can find that in ourselves. So just being humble and knowing I don't have to be the best. I just have to be the best I can be with what God has given me and trusting God for my identity. So that's where I find security. But if we find our boss is a narcissist, that's where in the New Testament, there's this amazing verse where it talks about, you know what, in the end, Jesus is the boss of bosses. Work for him. Like, okay, yes, you have this boss here, but in the end, you're working for Jesus. So imagine Jesus is your boss. How can I use this work to glorify Jesus, bring his love, mercy, beauty on this planet? How can I find a good outlet for my image of God and creativity? And it says that Jesus sees everything and he will reward you. So part of what annoys us is we have a radar for justice. And whenever we feel something's unfair, it's basically the first kid word a kid learns, not fair, not fair. But we have a radar for justice. So when a boss doesn't treat us justly, I think that's what causes the dissonance. But the Bible promises, no, no, Jesus sees everything, and one day he will reward you for your work.
Okay. Well, please join me in thanking Sam.
All right. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.